The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and our program is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with rethinking how the Egyptians built the pyramids. Now, this article is written by Ben McGrath that appeared in the December 2025 issue of National Geographic. Now, the editors note, a lost diary and a hidden waterway are offering surprising new origin story for Giza's ancient wonders. Now, before we read Ben McGrath's story, I want to read a brief introduction that was prepared by Amy Briggs. And it has the title, Nothing Has Captured Our Imagination Quite Like the Pyramids of Giza. Built 4,600 years ago during Egypt's Old Kingdom, the three monuments served to honor and house the remains of the pharaohs, Khufu, Khafre, and grandson, Manakore. Now, in the thousands of years that have followed, they awed and inspired everyone from the ancient Greeks to Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, for several thousand years, the Great Pyramid reigned supreme as the world's tallest human-made structure, originally standing 481 feet high. The pyramids are icons of ingenuity and imagination, and yet, almost from the moment they were constructed, they have been shrouded in mysteries. Perhaps the biggest and most popular one is, how exactly were they built? The Great Pyramid comprises over 2 million stone blocks, some weighing more than 50 tons. Where did the material come from? And how did it get to the middle of the desert? And how did the ancient Egyptians stack all those giant blocks? It's a centuries-old puzzle, with theories being embraced one day and discarded the next. But a new hypothesis is generating some staying power, thanks to a slew of recent discoveries, including a hidden diary and a lost river. Now, included with the article are some graphics and maps, so let me read from a couple of captions to give you some more background. The first one comes from, the first one is titled, I should say, Clues from an Ancient Text. Last year, researchers published evidence of the role of a large maritime project had in creating the pyramids. The findings build on previous studies and information gleaned from the Red Sea Scrolls, discovered in 2013 by French Egyptologist Pierre Tillet. Among them was the 4,600-year-old diary of an inspector named Merer. Now, that explained how he and his team transported massive blocks, stone blocks, along the Nile when river levels swelled with rainwater from upstream in the Ethiopian highlands. And then it goes on to describe these construction projects done pretty much by seasons. Winter construction, high water receded in November, making it difficult to move heavy loads by boat. Merer's journal describes spending the winter months traveling north to the delta to build a harbor. Then we move to spring. Spring resupply in April, Merer led a 40-person crew on a journey across the eastern desert to Wadi al-Jarf, a port on the Red Sea coast. Now, from there, teams sailed to the Sinai to fetch copper for stone-cutting tools. Now we move to the summer flood season. When Nile waters were high, workers transported stone from the Tura quarries in the Giza site. Merer recorded the work his team performed on the project's infrastructure, including artificial lakes and dikes. And then the next one is titled A Lost River Revealed, and Merer's aquatic journey may sound impossible. Today, the land surrounding the pyramids is awash in desert sand, but in 2023, a team led by geomorphologist Iman Gnonheim from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, found evidence of a lost branch of the Nile lying closer to the pyramids. They named it Oretme. That's Arabic for pyramids, though some scholars call it in the western branch of the Nile. Now, using geophysical surveys, radar satellite imagery, and deep soil coring, the team found that the branch's course closely tracked along the building sites of the pyramids, showing how the Aramat's presence might have been a critical factor in determining where Egypt's most famous monuments were constructed. So a lot of background there that helps you. Now let's begin Ben McGrath's article, again titled The Mystery That Still Endures. So the pyramids might have been a kind of marine industrial project, and what we now know as the sandblasted Giza Plateau perhaps bordered a bustling harbor. It takes some time getting used to. Those giant triangles in the desert, at once confounding to modern adults and relatable to preschoolers everywhere, have spawned so many crazy ideas that they long ago began to seem like primeval provocations. Now, some of this, including the persistent notion that these are alien deposits, was owed to the implausible sourcing and transport of so much raw material, hurdles that recede after the discovery of a lost branch of the Nile. But the pyramid's final assembly instructions remain lost in the mail. We know only that they are uncannily aligned with the cardinal directions and that their bases are remarkably square, evidence of precision and mathematical savvy to match the apparent brawn. Or maybe no brawn was necessary, considered the so-called sleeping prophet. About 100 years ago, a Kentucky man named Edgar Casey began branching out from the modest fame he'd achieved as a clairvoyant, diagnosing patients while under hypnosis, to the subject of the pyramids and the highly evolved souls who must have produced them. It came to him in a trance. They'd migrated from Atlantis, the ostensibly mythical island, before it sank. They chose Giza as an appropriate spot for a shrine, according to his vision, because it was at or near the center of the planet's landmasses, and therefore buffered from devastating quakes and floods. It wouldn't just up and vanish like their homeland. Now, we're talking around 10,500 B.C. The pharaohs, Khufu and Khafre and Menkaure, from this perspective, could be seen as merely several in a long line of latter-day opportunists claiming the cool geometry for their own designs. The stones were levitated through the use of those forces in nature as make for iron to swim in the air, Casey intoned, while his secretary transcribed. Curiously, he also said that erecting the Great Pyramid took 100 years, far longer than the 20 or 30 estimated by classical historians and present-day Egyptologists alike. Now, one might ask, what good is levitation if it's so much slower than manual labor? The placing of the capstone, long since missing, if it ever existed, was accompanied by a loud clanging of metal, Casey said, to which we owe the tradition of church bells. Casey was no longer alive when 1958 came and went. That was the year he'd said the science of levitation would be rediscovered. Supposedly, there was a hall of records buried beneath the right forepaw of the Sphinx in Giza by the Atlanteans, who wished to document how it had all come to pass. Those secrets in the Hall of Records were what motivated a college dropout from North Dakota, Mark Lenner, to seek the counsel of Hugh Lynn Casey, the prophet's son, in the early 1970s. With funding and encouragement from the Casey Foundation, Lenner then traveled to Egypt and resumed his studies at the American University in Cairo. Thus began a decades-long career of investigation and excavation in which Lenner seemed to find nothing more valuable than a love of painstaking, evidence-based research. He's now one of the world's foremost Egyptologists. From fringe to fastidious in a geological blink, maybe the line was never as stark as we like to think. Lenner's effort to test the Casian chronology in 1984 used radiocarbon dating of the interstitial organic matter between the stones, flakes of charcoal for the most part. He thought the results puzzling, but not in a way that supported the levitation hypothesis. The charcoal was a few hundred years, but not 7,000 or 8,000 years older than Khufu. Might the pyramid's builder have been burning old-growth forest for their mortar? To some, this left just enough uncertainty to sustain the guessing game. If not levitation, then what? To call those things stones is an understatement, on the order of Monty Python's flesh wound for amputated arms. Each weighs about as much as a minivan. Some, like the granite slabs over Khufu's chamber, are heavier than semi-trucks, but at least a van or a truck has wheels. A few decades ago, Joseph Davidovits, a chemical engineer in France, couldn't seem to fathom the manipulation of so much unyielding weight without modern technology and proposed an oddly contemporary solution. The building blocks, in his view, were not in fact stones at all, and instead had themselves been constructed, cast in place using wooden molds and a soft limestone slurry that could be slept upstairs in baskets. Think of them as Potemkin pyramids. You can almost conjure the squinting smiles on the ancient cement mixers' faces as they neared the apex and imagined people in the distant future scratching heads and crediting them with an order of strength they didn't yet know to call Herculean. Or you could, that is, until the Inspector Mera's diary, written 4,600 years ago and discovered in 2013, documented intact stone sliding downriver, basket-free. And then there are still those vaulted slabs to account for, undeniably granite, harder to fabricate. The Frenchman didn't dispute their natural origin, nor did he provide an entirely satisfactory answer to the question of why people who could lift trucks shouldn't have been expected to try lifting vans as well. The Internet made scholars of anyone with a modem and an obsession. At the same time, rapid advances in computer technology were beginning to threaten our brains, and with obsolescence, a new genre of pyramid specialists emerged, backyard tinkerers, pragmatists who could differentiate the fourth from the third dynasty, and found comfort in the idea of a more muscular or elemental sort of ingenuity. They tended to focus less on the industrial logistics, the quarrying, the staffing, the room and board, than on the more viscerally gratifying act of stacking. If society collapses and we're back in the Stone Ages, I'm a beaking of the heap, a retired Mississippi newspaper man told me several years ago, after working up the courage to reveal a passion project that he feared could out him as a Don Quixote figure. His name was Roger Larson, and he had built, he said, a device to raise stones up the face of an Egyptian pyramid. I wouldn't necessarily have pegged myself as an ideal audience for such a boast. I was by then faintly familiar with the concept of pyramidiots, whose novel ideas included flying enormous kites to lift obelisks and making many rafts of inflated animal skins that could be lashed as large stones and then fed into a vast plumbing system, employing locks to thwart gravity. Those sounded to me like Rube Goldberg fantasies. When contemplating the pyramids, I tended to shudder at the sheer scale of all that toil in the service of an ideal so limited that it boggled my secular egalitarian mind. Providing a nice afterlife for the pharaoh, a man lucky enough to have been born rich, the majesty was almost an affront to my middle-aged inclination to idleness. In this respect, I was a little like Pliny the Elder, the great Roman naturalist and author of the first encyclopedia, who gave us one of the oldest surviving accounts of the pyramids as seen through a tourist eyes. Publishing shortly after the profligate reign of Nero in the first century A.D., Pliny criticized the transparent vainglory the Giza structures represented, quote, the superfluous and foolish display of wealth, unquote. On the other hand, there was something appealingly democratic in the rise of an army of resourceful autodidacts against a gatekeeping archaeological establishment, and Larson, who shared snippets of dispiriting correspondence with professors he emailed cold, was nothing if not well-read, sprinkling references to the inspiration he'd found in his Isis knots and the slotted ends of Djed pillars on the walls of Abydos. Now, he was convinced that earthen ramps, favored by many academics as a likely means of escorting heavy material into thin air, and this was shown in a graphic on another page, it's done by a sledge, and he says they were a non-starter. Any ramp approaching Khufu's upper reaches that was sufficiently gentle to allow dragging heavy blocks would be more voluminous than the monument itself and might extend a mile or more, surely leaving some archaeological trace. As with Casey's purported Hall of Records, why hadn't anyone found anything? Pliny, for what it's worth, reported that he'd heard stories of salt and soda ramps which could have been washed away by floodwaters. Though they acknowledged that some of his contemporaries had a hard time believing this, the lost Nile branch wouldn't be rediscovered for nearly 2,000 years. I don't think the Egyptians could have made sandals fast enough to keep the work going, Larson said. I decided to take him up on his offer to prove the concept. The contraption was composed of logs that he'd sawed from a forest, along with lengths of knotted rope. The ancient Egyptians were known to have imported cedars from Lebanon, Larson noted. It looked like a catapult, but with oars instead of a central lever, arguably a Herodotus machine, described only vaguely by the Greek historian from his sources in the 5th century B.C., as having short pieces of timber and operating in a stepladder fashion. Larson had assembled it in a backwoods borrow pit, at the top of a soft limestone embankment with a 48-degree slope, close enough, he figured, to the Great Pyramid's 52. Taking in the scene, I half expected to see Charlton Heston striding into view, hoisting the Ten Commandments. YouTube popularity is the amateur Egyptologist Ivy League sinecure, and for the sake of what he called dramatic appeal in his video-making, Larson said that he had previously tried raising a pickup. The rope snapped, and the truck went rolling to the edge of a pond. Back to the drawing board. For my demonstration, he used a large concrete block topped with slabs of marble. Together, they weighed 4,500 pounds and sat on a pair of skis at the base of a poplar track that he'd affixed to the cliff face. Like any pyramid architect, Larson needed manpower. His own arms, he joked, were toothpicks, so he hired out for muscle by offering $50 in stray favors to friends and acquaintances. I should note that these people all looked sane and genuinely skeptical. Soon he had a super antediluvian construction site with soundtracks of grunting, creaking, and laughing. The creaking came from the ropes as several men attended to each oar, first walking it up and then pushing it back down a set of stairs flanking the main frame. The block slid up the track like a funicular in slow motion, a foot or two with each cycling of the oars. "It's a little tedious, isn't it?" Larson said, admitting that several dozen such devices and perhaps a few more sets of muscles on each oar might be needed to meet the rate of delivery required of such a massive project if it were to be completed within a pharaoh's lifetime. So many were the stones composing the Great Pyramid that Napoleon, who'd asked a legion of savants with mapping the joint, is said to have quipped that they could be repurposed to form a 10-foot wall around the perimeter of France. Almost true. As I've calculated it, the wall, perhaps fittingly, would have come up short. But the atmosphere in Mississippi grew festive over the course of a couple of hours as Larson's block neared the embankment's edge. Here stood a man who had willed into being, through the force of his own mania, a community effort so chaotic that it couldn't help stirring wonder. I thought of the graffiti on chamber walls that modern scholars have attributed to Khufu's construction gangs. Far from complaining, they seemed to be bragging. What drove Larson and his makeshift crew may not have been so different from what motivated their predecessors in antiquity, a conviction that they were engaged in something rare and in so doing were potentially slipping the bonds of time. The block reached the lip at last. Larson proclaimed himself the first human in more than 4,000 years to achieve this, whatever it was. One down, or up, rather, 2 million more to go. And now we're back at the crux of the pyramid saga, a story that is really less about technology than about patience, process, and follow-through, the stuff of which civilization is made. French Egyptologist Pierre Tillet had been sifting Egypt's dirt for more than 20 years, a sizable pharaonic term, before he found the Red Sea Scrolls in 2013. You can't expect to close your eyes and visualize the secret to an essentially political project any more than you can concentrate hard enough to levitate a rock. You need to keep digging, keep reading, keep wheedling, until one day the accumulation of all that effort will amount to something that our descendants can marvel at. Well, not long ago, Larson emailed me to say that his friend Leon, whose burrow pit he had been using for the demonstrations, had other designs on the property. My pyramid device is still sitting on the cliff edge, rotting and drooping, he wrote. It will be pushed over the cliff and buried today, but I asked Leon to leave the 2-ton concrete block as a relic. If somebody gets interested in the demonstrations, there will be some physical proof of what was done. They can't suggest that I packed the block with styrofoam. Sure they can. What good is a mystery without a trace of conspiracy? Oh, my word. What a story there, huh? Well, our next story is focused on this question. Can the historical information locked away in polar ice sheets be retrieved before it all melts? Now, Saving Stories Trapped in Ice is a story written by Douglas Fox. It appears in the December 25th, 2025, issue of National Geographic. In the summer of 2022, a small but bustling town appeared atop the normally barren Greenland ice sheet. Rows of red tents flapped in the wind, and an LC-130 Hercules cargo plane occasionally delivered food, fuel, and equipment. But the camp's main activity lay hidden 30 feet below the surface in a network of tunnels that workers had spent weeks chainsawing. And when I say chainsawing, they were going into ice. Now, researchers bundled in down jackets toiled around the clock in these snowy tunnels as a massive drill rig churned downward to extract core samples and the secrets they contained from the deepest recesses of the ice sheet below. Now, some of these cylindrical ice cores, each about the width of a pool noodle, hadn't seen daylight for 100,000 years. They're clear and flawless, like window glasses, Jørgen Peter Steffensen, a glaciologist at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, Denmark, who, along with glaciologist Dorothy Dahl Jensen, oversaw the camp's daily operations. Researchers working in the Arctic and Antarctica have come to realize that this ice provides a rare view of the past, one that's disappearing rapidly as climate change speeds melting at the poles. The vast ice sheets that cover Greenland and Antarctica formed one snowflake at a time as winter flurries piled on top of each other and slowly compressed into ice. Air pockets between the snowflakes coalesced into bubbles that shrank and dissolved under great pressure, infusing the ice with a mix of carbon dioxide, and other trapped gases, a perfect snapshot of the atmosphere. Now, here's what's unique about the ice core, says Frank Wilhelms, a glaciologist at the Alfred Wegener Institute, a hub for polar research in Bremerhaven, Germany. You get direct access to a million-year-old air, he said. By analyzing gases trapped in the ice, scientists can reconstruct fluctuations in greenhouse gases over time and, in some cases, trace them to likely causes, such as wildfires, the increased growth of forest, and wetlands that soak up carbon dioxide, or in more recent samples, fossil fuels. By measuring traces of sulfuric acid, beryllium, and chlorine, they can see past volcanic eruptions and changes in the sun's brightness, which can also influence the climate. And by studying the oxygen atoms in water molecules, they can estimate atmospheric temperatures. And there's several graphics as I flip the pages here to carry us forward, and I want to be able to read those, but let me continue with the story. Scientists combined this information with data from tree rings and seafloor sediment cores to reconstruct how greenhouse gases influenced rain and snowfall patterns, growing seasons, and the stability of ice sheets. They can then develop computer models that capture the nuanced effects of greenhouse gases and accurately forecast how rising emissions will change our climate. Ice cores can also illuminate the grand arc of human civilization. In layers from the past 3,000 years, Steffensen and his colleagues have measured airborne lead pollution that settled over the Arctic as the Phoenicians, Romans, and medieval Europeans mined and smelted silver. Temporary dips in that pollution marked societal upheavals like the decline of the Roman Empire after AD 400 and the Black Death, which began around 1350. Now, Steffensen's team has estimated that pollution was severe enough across much of the Roman Empire to cause mild lead poisoning and reductions in IQ. Panning out, these ice cores show that during the last ice age, which began 120,000 years ago, Earth's climate swung violently between cold, dry spells and warmer, wetter periods. Modern humans existed throughout that time, but there's no evidence that they settled down and learned to farm. Climate change forced them to move all the time, speculates Stephenson. Then around 11,700 years ago, the climate warmed and stabilized, and within 1,000 years, farming societies rose in the Fertile Crescent, India, and South America. The last 11,000 years are, climate-wise, the most stable that we've seen in the past several hundred thousand years, says Stephenson. It was only during this period, a sort of stable climatic oasis, that human civilization flowered into cities, kingdoms, and countries. And now we're upsetting the apple cart, he says, referring to the roughly 2.5 trillion tons of carbon dioxide that humans have pumped into the atmosphere since 1850. Unsurprisingly, the subsequent global warming is speeding up the ice sheet's natural melting processes and sending the gargantuan masses of ice surging into the ocean, along with the records they keep. The block of ice where the camp's set, for example, is sliding toward the sea at a staggering rate of 3,000 feet per year at its coastal outlet and continues to accelerate about 1% each year. It's one of the components of sea level rise that's accelerating the most, says Dahl Jensen. By seeking out these fragile records in the ice, scientists hope to reconstruct the past while they still can, allowing them to predict the future. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's take a look some more at some of the graphics with Douglas Fox's article. They're basically photographs. They were taken by photographer Wukas Waseska. Now, it is a two-page color photo that we're going to focus on next, which depicts four samples of these ice cores we described, and they're taken, remember, from the Greenland ice cover. The captions for the samples are going to tell us more. So here's the first one. While documenting the collection and analysis of ice cores, photographer Lukas Larsen-Warseka took artistic liberties and used gel filters to tint cores to the climatic or historical events they represent. The clear band in the center of this core, and it's one that's got red on one end and then fades slowly into different shades of purple and white on the next end. The clear band in the center of the core from Greenland, which was formed in the summer of 1889 when a major warming event turned the entire ice sheet's surface to water. It's the only incident where the top of the ice sheet melted from the year 1000 to the turn of the millennium. In the 25 years since 2000, similar melting events have occurred four times. So the ice does reveal those melting events. Next sample looks like pure crystal white ice core, but measurable changes in the chemical composition and purity of snowfall allow researchers to view past this surprisingly high resolution and often help them pinpoint specific years or seasons with a column of ice. Now, this sample contains snow that fell during the Northern Hemisphere's winter season in the year AD1, marking what some consider the first white Christmas. Wow. Well, the next sample is kind of interesting. It's also clear, not as azure or bluish as the previous. This half-moon-shaped chunk of ice belongs to an ice core sample that stretches back approximately 1.5 million years, extracted by members of the Beyond Epica project from a 10,000-foot thick slab of ice near Antarctica's Concordia station. And finally, in 1783, the eruption of Laki, a volcanic fissure in Iceland, blotted out the sun and blanketed the region in noxious fumes. Around a fifth of the island's population starved, and crops failed across Europe in the following winter, fomenting social unrest that, according to some researchers, may have sparked the French Revolution. And the core shown here from the Greenland ice sheet, lit to mimic France's tricolored flag, contains sulfuric acid, which was from the eruption. And there, my friends, is the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, inviting you to join us again next week. I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina.